Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And we are so happy to have Brian Fagan with us. He is the author of The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Brian has been with us before for a very entertaining hour. He's emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was born in England. He's done field work in Africa and many other parts of the world, has written about early human beings, forensic archaeology, and other topics. He's written several books on the interaction of climate and human society, and he lectures frequently around the world. The editor of the Oxford Companion to Archaeology, he has that title. He's the author of Fish on Friday, Feasting, Fasting, and the Discovery of the New World, The Long Summer, and The Little Ice Age. The Great Warming explores societies, he says, both historically obscure and also those well known. You can't understand the significance of the medieval warming period without traveling far beyond Europe, where the effects of the warmer centuries were strongly positive, and the continent saw the cultural flowering that we now call the High Middle Ages. The higher temperatures and the accompanying drifts in rainfall patterns rippled across the globe, bringing both opportunity and catastrophe. And the catastrophe he writes extensively about is drought. He also ties this in to dry spells now and what it means to be having climate change now, that the medieval warm period tells us about how we adapt to climatic crisis and offers a forewarning of lengthy droughts when warming occurs and how incredibly devastating that could be for us. We'll be welcoming phone calls. It's a topic that gathers a lot of interest, so I'm sure you'll want to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Brian Fagan, hello. Thanks again so much for being with us.
Good morning, and it's lovely to be back with you.
Tell me, you looked at climate change between the 10th and the 15th centuries. What's happened technologically in the last 20 years, you write about us, that has allowed us to pinpoint many of those changes?
Well, we've been living through a wonderful, and it is wonderful, revolution in the study of ancient climate, which has involved much more than the rather crude geology, which was all we had before. One of the major techniques has been deep sea cores, boring down into the depths of the ocean. This is the oldest of these techniques, which has been around a while in the Pacific and the Atlantic, which has given us a long view of the Ice Age. More importantly, from our point of view, deep ice cores bored into the Greenland ice sheet, into Antarctica, into the Andes, have given us a relatively fine-grained impression of the last 2,000 years of climate, and most important of all, are tree rings, which the growth rings, annual growth rings of trees. Again, a technique that's been around a long time, but it's really been refined in recent years, particularly on German oaks. Mm. And we now have tree ring records, which are remarkably complete for Europe for the last 2,000 years. As a result, we are getting a much more fine-grained picture of how climate and history intersect.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed seeing how some parts of the world were utterly devastated during this time period and other places just flourished. It was so dramatic in different parts of the world, wasn't it?
It really shook me when I wrote the book, because I started researching this book and I really was going to work mainly on Europe, and I had this impression of apple-cheeked peasants enjoying bountiful harvests, as illustrated by Bruegel, who actually appears on the cover of the book. But when I started looking outside Europe, because really I realized you can't look at this except globally, I was shaken, because here was widespread drought over enormous tracts of particularly the Western United States, Central America, Peru, and around there, which must have had a dramatic effect on all kinds of human societies.
Mm-hmm. You start in the early chapters of the book, you start with Pueblo Benito, 1,000 years ago, a very sacred place, and then what happened because of this very long period of drought. Describe in some detail what happened there.
Pueblo Benito, of course, is one of the great pueblos, or great houses, as scholars often call them, in Chaco Canyon in the New Mexico, the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, which flourished in the late first millennium A.D. And this place, which is a semicircular pueblo with multiple stories, flourished in an environment where you really couldn't support more than about 2,500 people. The unpredictable rainfall, and one of the great mysteries of archaeology has been to try and explain why this place was so intensively built up with not just Pueblo Bonito, but other great houses as well. Mm. And it seems it was a major center of seasonal ceremonials for the ancestral Pueblo. And then, one thing we do have here, of course, are remarkably complete tree rig records, really precise. There were hundreds of sequences now across the southwest, many of them coming from old Pueblo beams, which is preserved in the very dry climate.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that Pueblo Bonito was abandoned at the height or during a major drought cycle in the 11th century, and that there was some connection between the abandonment and the disperse and this drought. There was a tradition in Pueblo, oral tradition, of movement in the face of drought, and what people did was simply move away family by family to live with relatives who were living in better watered areas elsewhere, mm-hmm. in an ancient tradition of movement. Now, what one cannot say, obviously, is that this abandonment of Chaco Canyon was caused entirely by climate. There must have been other factors involved as well, but it's certainly very suggestive.
Mm-hmm. And what does it look like now?
Pueblo Bonito?
Mm-hmm.
You haven't been there?
No.
Oh,
no.
Put it on your list.
Okay.
No, it's absolutely stunning place.
Really?
It is a dry canyon with a watercourse through the middle of it, which occasionally flows after major thunderstorms, in this very semi-arid area of spectacular scenery. And this magnificent gorge with rosy cliffs, which are really quite spectacular, suddenly appears. It's sort of inconspicuous. And in it are the ruins of these great houses and great kivas or semi-subterranean ceremonial structures, which are so brown that they sort of meld into the landscape. And it truly is unexpected, exciting, and dramatic.
Mm. It must have been very hard, Professor Fagan, for all of those people to go elsewhere. They were walking there, weren't they? Or how did they get to...
They were tough.
Yeah.
They didn't have our sense of time. Their culture was basically pretty mobile. They built pueblos, but the remainder of their material culture was relatively simple, relatively portable, and they moved. And actually, there's an even more dramatic example up in the Moctezuma Valley, right up in the Four Corners region, where a large pueblo was abandoned, and the people simply left their grinding stones there.
Oh, my.
So they were used to moving. They traveled long distances, and there's abundant evidence that many people came to Chaco for long distances for major ceremonies. And another very interesting thing is to build these pueblos took enormous numbers of beams. Mm-hmm. And these beams, apparently, some of them were cut as much as 50 miles away and carried in.
Mm.
So you're talking people who were used to be mobile.
Mm-hmm. To another part of the world and an equally dramatic story, Angkor Wat in Cambodia.
Have you been there?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
But seriously, again, put it on your list.
All right.
Is the most extraordinary place. It's enormous. It beggars description.
Mm.
It makes the temple of the sun god Amun at Karnak look like a country village church, or Westminster Abbey look teeny, or the National Cathedral look insignificant. It covers about 2 miles. It's a huge ceremonial complex, which is a mixture of a mortuary temple and a palace built by Sayavarman, a Khmer monarch. It's visited by increasing numbers of people. They're estimating 4 million people a year.
Oh, my.
By the year 2020, I think, you must go before it gets absolutely inundated. It really is spectacular.
Mm.
I'm spending a lot of your money here. but the thing about Angkor Wat is that it is a masterpiece of Khmer architecture and art, which was built at vast expense to honor a ruler who considered himself a god.
Hmm.
But an archaeologist for years, quite naturally, concerned with the conservation of it, which is another issue, have studied it in detail. What they did not study until recently was the hinterland around it, because the whole Khmer Empire was supported by monsoon rain. Hmm. When the rain came, the Mekong River flooded, you got huge inundations, which inundated and filled reservoirs which they built. What is now appearing from the surveys around Angkor Wat is, in fact, that the Khmer were in a constant tizzy to keep the reservoirs full and to make sure they didn't silt up, because a major problem with Angkor Wat was water shortages.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, after the medieval warm period, it appears possible that a series of monsoon failures caused by El Niños actually led to the demise of Angkor Wat. So again, mm-hmm. history may be being rewritten here.
Oh my. So it was abandoned. It was never really finished?
It was finished. One of these places, that, like Westminster Abbey, that's never finished. But it was basically abandoned, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But people still lived in the area.
Now let's go to Europe during this same time period, where we've got Chartres being built. Europe's basking in a warm climate. They have a whole series of good harvests. People are thanking God and the unknown powers, as you write, of the cosmos for their bounty, building a cathedral in gratitude, partially because the weather allowed them to do that.
Well, it's a little misleading. You look at the Bruegel painting, actually, which is on the cover of the book, and you think, wow, this was a wonderful warm period with year after year of bountiful climate and plentiful surpluses. In fact, and this actually is, again, a rather fascinating thing about the medieval warm period, is that almost all of Europe lived at the subsistence level. They lived from one harvest to the next.
Hmm.
Life was brutal. Life expectancy was approximately 28. And everyone, pretty well, experienced hunger during their lives. As a result, they really had a pretty insecure existence. And during the medieval warm, when there were, and there is the great myth about the medieval warm, it was always, always warm and beautiful. And there were some wet summers and so on. There does seem to have been a tendency towards slightly higher temperatures, maybe 1.5 degrees centigrade, to slightly drier summers, which is important because that affects the length of the growing season.
Right.
Ample sunshine. And there were years after years of excellent harvests. The result was food surpluses and wealth, which went into building cathedrals, growth of population, deforestation, and a whole lot of things going on which were part of the formation of the High Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a time of prosperity and growing cities, but how spectacular it was is a question.
Mm.
We do know, for example, that wine was a major industry in England, of all places. Central England had vineyards, and they were exporting so much wine from England that the French were complaining.
Oh, my.
So there were things going on that we still only dimly understand.
Yeah. There were favorable ice conditions in the north because of this warming period. Who took advantage of that? How did the world change because of that?
The Norse, of course, the Vikings. And please, when you think of the Norse, don't think of Kirk Douglas and that ghastly epic of the 1950s or 60s with warships and orgies and all that sort of thing. Think of the Norse, which they were, as absolutely consummate sailors and traders.
Mm-hmm.
And during this period, ice conditions in the north were considerably more favorable, which is very, very important when you sail the sort of rather flexible hulled ships that the Norse had. Because if you get those ships in floating ice, you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And during this period, they were able to sail to Ireland, they sailed to the Faroe Islands, they sailed to Iceland by 935, and then, of course, Eric the Red went to Greenland, and then from there they went across to Labrador and to Newfoundland. And one of the big attractions of Labrador was the fact that it had timber, And one of the things I've theorized about is that, in fact, the people living in Greenland, which is a timberless environment, may have relied on the forests of Labrador for timber for their ships, because a ship, with the hard use of those days, probably didn't last much longer than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of fun with that.
What caused the warm period, Professor Fagan?
Nobody really knows. One of the big areas of research is into the very complex interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere. And these interactions are still virtually not understood. We're spending enormous sums of money on climate change for obvious reasons. And this is an area they're working on intensively. Another area which is very important here is the tilt of the Earth's axis. And it may be that the slightly warmer conditions of the medieval warm period were changed, caused by a slight tilt in the Earth's axis.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Brian Fagan. And we'll do so in just one moment. He's the author of a number of books. We're talking about the great warming, climate change, and the rise and fall of civilizations. Could be subtitled, What a Difference a Degree Makes. From the 10th until the 15th century, the Earth experienced a rise in average temperature that changed the climate worldwide. A preview, and he spends quite a bit of time on today's global warming as well. He looks at how these shifts in the environment had amazing effects on human life. He looks at North and Central America. He looks at Asia. He looks at Europe. And we will move into a discussion of modern times and what we can learn from this warm period or drought period, which was what was most devastating to civilizations, the lessons that it has for us now. Join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, you can reach us at 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Brian is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was born in England. He's done, as you can hear, he's been everywhere in the world, did field work in Africa, and has written about early man, forensic archaeology, and many other topics. His books on the interaction of climate and human society have established him as a leading authority on the subject, and he lectures all over the world on this. Join us. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050 for you to join this conversation on the great warming. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Brian Fagan is our guest. His book is The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, or you can send an email at talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls, Brian, with Tom from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I got a question about what do you think about the Mayan mysteries and the year 2012 and the mysteries surrounding that year?
The year what? I didn't hear that, Brian. What year?
2012.
I didn't hear the question.
I want to know what you think about the mysteries of the Mayan prophecies in the year 2012.
The Mayan prophecies?
The what of 2012?
The Mayan prophecies of 2012.
Oh, that's garbage. I don't take a notice of that sort of stuff. You know, they're always producing these sort of things, and I just sit back and sigh. The whole climate change thing is crammed with visionaries and prophets of doom, and in my world, I just sit back and say, oh, God, and go along. I'm being rather frank here, but the waters are so muddied here that I tend to let the prophecies do their thing.
Thanks very much for the call. You write toward the end of the book, Brian, about our entering an era where extreme aridity will affect a large portion of the world's now much higher population, and we're looking at much, much higher than the period that you were writing about. The challenges of adapting to water shortages, crop failures are infinitely more complex, and one can only hope that our qualities of adaptiveness, ingenuity, and opportunism will carry us through an uncertain and challenging future, and indeed that's what it is.
Yes, indeed. And one another thing which absolutely shook me with this book, and I really had no idea the stuff was out here, was when I started pulling it all together, I thought to myself, well, I wonder if this has any effect on modern drought. And then I came across these projections from the Hadley Institute in England, which is a highly respected meteorological institute. And they've done these very sophisticated computer models of the future. These aren't prophecies. These are based on hard science, the most sophisticated you can do. And the figures were devastating. I mean, they're forecasting that by the year 2100, that the percentage of the world's surface, which is suffering from extreme drought, not just severe, but extreme, will rise from 3 to 18%.
Oh, my.
And that 40% of the Earth's land surface will be affected by regular drought. And, of course, the implications of this for us here in the West is frightening. And there seems to be steady denial of it. I read in the paper this morning, there's a report on snowpack in the West. This happens to have been a relatively good year for rainfall and snowpack. Is the drought over? And the kind of implication is just relax, people. Mm. Don't worry about it, which is nonsense. We have a serious problem. And one of the big issues to me with the future in climate isn't just rising sea levels and melting ice sheets. It's drought. Mm. And this is the elephant in the climatic room that we're kind of ignoring.
And also how we're using the water, the precious water that we have now.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the fascinating ones, take something that seems trivial, but it actually isn't, is golf courses.
Right.
And I use this example because a lot of people play golf. Golf courses, of course, depend on water. But how much longer are we going to be able to afford to water the thousands of acres of golf courses in the deserts, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to develop a new form of golf which uses different surfaces? It isn't a question of are we going to. I think we're going to have to do it.
Hmm.
And things like that. And I think lawns of a dying species and things like that. So we really are in a changing world.
Yeah. You talk about it. I love your descriptions of places that you've been and what you've seen. In your chapter, The Silent Elephant, you talk about an arid landscape imprinting itself on your mind. You remember it as if it was yesterday, November days of over 40 years ago. Can you talk about that some?
Oh, yes. I was terribly lucky, actually. I spent the first 7 years of my life in the Third World, in Africa. In my 20s, I was doing about 9 months in the bush a year, spending a lot of time living among subsistence farmers. And this completely changed my views of humanity and of life. This sounds awfully pompous, but it really did, because I was working at one point in the Middle Zambezi Valley, which is very low-lying, extremely hot, and very irregular rainfall. And every September, the temperatures would rise at the end of the dry season, and the temperatures would rise as the people cleared and fired their land, letting the undergrowth burn and the ash fertilize the soil. And then they would wait and wait and wait to plant, while each afternoon clouds built on the western horizon. You saw flashes of lightning, and the temperatures got higher and higher and higher, up in the 105, 110 degree range.
Mm.
And the people just sweated. And then there was that glorious day, and tensions had risen, when it would rain.
Mm.
And there'd be a heavy shower. And this wonderful smell you get off, as you know, dry ground. And then the next day, the people would plant. And then they would wait, and they would wait, and they would wait.
Mm.
Sometimes it would rain again, but all too often it didn't, and there was hunger. And I really learned at first hand how people depend on one another, because rainfall falls in one place and not on another, how there were these complicated ties of reciprocity between different groups, how important kin ties are and family. And it really shook me, and I've never forgotten it, and it's affected everything I've done in archaeology ever since.
Oh, my.
I'm very lucky to have had that powerful experience.
Yeah. And now, the last couple of weeks particularly, we're getting these horrendous stories of hunger in the world, of part of the hunger being caused by drought.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We haven't seen a thing yet. I mean, I sound like a doomsday sayer, which I hope I am not, because I have a very strong optimism that humanity will adapt. But one of the problems with the lack of consciousness among people about drought and its dangers is that an awful lot of this is unfolding in the developing world, in a world that's really rather far out of our consciousness, preoccupied as we are with things like Iraq and oil. And really, Europeans are much more aware of this than we are. But let me give you a figure. In the 19th century, between 20 and 30 million people, all of them tropical farmers, perished as a result of drought and monsoon failures in the tropical world. And this is at level zero on our historical radar. And that was a time when many fewer people in the world. Today, with many more people, and you can see this happening in Darfur, in Ethiopia, the casualty rates are frightening. And this isn't an issue for just them. It's an issue for the whole of humanity.
Sure.
Because one thing that is quite clear is that the wars of the future aren't going to be fought over trivial nationalisms or religious doctrines. They're going to be fought over one word, water.
Edith from Madison, hi.
Yes, hi, good morning. Coming from the standpoint of an interest in architecture and the history of architecture, I read a book a very, very, very long time ago, which wasn't on that subject, but gave me some information. It was called The Norse, and it described how in Northern Europe and Great Britain specifically, the Romans came with the invention of their type of heating system called hypocausts, which were ducts in the floors of dwellings that carried hot water from place to place from a central fire, and that in cruder dwellings they just consisted of a thatch hut with a hole in the roof through which fire smoke could escape. But following the Romans, there seemed to be a climate change where all of Northern Europe grew colder, and that led to the invention of small rooms, each with its own fireplace, and chimneys, and covered over roofs. How does that fit in with what you have written in your book?
This is a fascinating question. And now, I'm going to theorize here because I'm not an expert on the Romans. But my impression of hypocausts and all of that, it required an enormous amount of labor to keep going. And much of that labor, cutting firewood, maintaining fires, heating water, probably was slave labor. The people with the holes in the roof were the average people, the subsistence farmers. And what you say about after Roman times, the small room and the chimneys is absolutely true, because one of the things that's really people forget, we live in central heating, we have a very efficient fireplaces, is how awful winters were for people during, say, the Little Ice Age. The only protection you had were the bodies of other people and clothing, because the number of people who really huddled close to a fire were very small indeed. So fires were a privilege, and it was a time of death and chill.
Thanks very much
for the call. What happened in America during this warm period?
We still are finding out. I mean, an awful lot of this is at its infancy, and we really are in the very early stages of a very exciting era of research. But it appears that the evidence mainly comes from the West, where they now have a grid of tree ring sequences from hundreds of locations, which are showing that the droughts of 1,000 years ago were truly epochal. Sorry about the noise. We have an ambulance going by. We we have an old people's home up the street, and we get a constant traffic, unfortunately. Anyway, there was a series of epochal droughts about 1,000 years ago, which are known from tree stumps found in dry lake beds in the Sierra Nevada. One of these droughts lasted 140 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And people are talking about, oh, the present drought, which started in 1999, is it finishing? You know, they've got this sort of naivety about it, largely because people are totally ignorant of these very large droughts. And the same aridity is expressed in the Southwest and also through wide areas of the West, including the Western Great Plains. The Eastern picture is less clear, but it is clear there were some drought incidents during this period.
We go to Paul next from Altoona. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
I'm wondering what your guest would say with respect to the warming period, particularly in Greenland of the past, to a global warming naysayer who would point to Greenland's warm past as evidence that these warming trends are cyclical and unavoidable.
The point about climate change is that there is really no such thing as a little ice age or a medieval warm period in the sense of a rigid geological sequence. There was constantly oscillation. And for example, to take it on a large scale, I think this is really what you're getting at, we have evidence from deep sea cores that there have been at least 9, probably more, intensely cold periods of global climate interspersed with warmer periods over the last 750,000 years. Now, if this is so, we ended an ice age about 15,000 years ago, and presumably in the natural force of things, we would see another ice age coming along in 10, 20, 30,000 years. We're in what they call an interglacial, a warm period. And normally one would assume this has happened. The question of questions is, will humanly caused warming interrupt this natural cycle? And the answer to this question is that no scientist I've talked to actually knows. But they suspect that our contribution to the atmosphere will have an effect. So we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Andy from Middleton next. Hi, Andy.
Good morning.
Good morning, Andy.
One of the things that has concerned me is that I read a book a number of years ago called the, I can't think of the name of the book. But anyway, the Cadillac Desert, I think it was, or Kettle. But anyway, that's the point I had to make is that you take particularly California or you take Arizona or New Mexico, and so much of the water that is there is used for the irrigation of farm crops, and this type of thing, and they feed livestock there, and I think that that's a very poor use of the water, because the water that is there ought to be used for human consumption or vegetables, and for the livestock production ought to be in the Midwest where there isn't a shortage of water.
I couldn't agree more with you, sir. You are absolutely correct. You've put your finger onto what is going to become a very, very central political problem in the next 20 or 30 years. It already is the whole issue of water rights.
The thing is that the way they price the water that the farmers have to pay for is ridiculously low as compared to, you know, other parts of the country.
Oh, indeed. How right you are.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the production of vegetables is a major part of, agriculture, the major part of California's economy. Oh, yes, I couldn't agree more.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very, very much for the call. You, in the final chapters of the book, Professor Fagan, talk about, and I don't think that this is on the radar screen of many people in this world at all, that the evidence is mounting that drought is the silent and insidious killer associated with global warming. About 11 million people between Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, in serious danger of starvation as a result of a multi-year drought in 2006. by 2010, around 300 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, nearly a third of the population, will suffer from malnutrition because of intensifying drought, and also the issue of children who are dying because of lack of access to good sanitation and clean drinking water. Those are astounding numbers.
They are indeed. And what you're looking at is a continent about which we are lamentably ignorant. The problem, one of the problems, and I please don't misunderstand this comment, is that when people think of Africa, they think of AIDS. And this is a catastrophic problem in Africa, into which a great deal of money has been poured. But you have to realize that nearly everybody in Africa lives at the subsistence level. And they live in areas of irregular rainfall, which are readily affected by things like El Niños, droughts, floods, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in the places where the infrastructure is not good, you're going to have a lot of people suffering from hunger and malnutrition who do it routinely. They suffer from it. So this is a tragic, tragic area. And one of the great priorities in the next 20 years for the developing world is to develop a far greater consciousness of Africa, which has tremendous potential as a global powerhouse. It really does. And it's a wonderful place.
More phone calls for Brian in just a moment. Brian Fagan is our guest this hour, author of The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Brian is Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was born in England. He has done field work all over the world and has written about forensic archaeology, early human beings. His books on the interaction of climate and human society have made him a leading authority on the subject. He lectures all over the world. He's the editor of the Oxford Companion to Archaeology, the author of Fish on Friday, Feasting, Fasting, and the Discovery of the New World, The Long Summer, and The Little Ice Age, among many other books. Join us. And we also have this email. If you want to use the email, go ahead and use the email. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, or 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Brian Fagan, our guest, The Great Warming, Climate Change, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations is what we're talking about. He looked at the period from the 10th to the 15th century when the Earth experienced a rise in average temperature that changed climate worldwide and resulted in some profound changes to civilizations around the world. Joe from Cottage Grove is our next caller. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Fagan, I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on technologies that are being established, like the water desalination and other technologies, and how they are these type of technologies going to be able to save us from having these problems in the future, these water wars, I guess you would say. And I'll just go ahead and take my answer off the air.
Take, for example, desalinization. This is a technology which is coming into its own. It's widely used already. There's only one problem with it. It's based on fossil fuels. It requires fossil fuels to run the plants. And that, of course, is another shortage and another problem. But there's no question that desalinization and increasingly efficient desalinization is a major part of our collective future. I think it's a mistake to think that our technological ingenuity is going to solve everything. I think many of the solutions are going to be low-tech. For example, in some semi-arid lands, like the Andes, they are rediscovering some of the ancient agricultural technologies, which were highly effective for coping with drought and with frost, indeed.
Really?
Yes, oh, indeed. And I suspect that a lot of research like this is going to produce some fairly dramatic results. We cannot rely wholly on technology, although it's enormously important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you so much for the call. Can you explain? I always have a hard time with these, and it's probably a pretty simple thing I'm just not getting. Can you talk about how the weather changers like El Nino and La Nina figured into this whole great warming and how they figure in now?
The sort of unpredictable seesaw, and a seesaw is the right word, of El Nino and the opposite, which of course is the cool, dry La Nina, which is the condition we're in, like condition we're in now, are probably the second most important factors in global climate and weather above the seasons. However, what we do not know is how all of this interlinks into global climate. But there is absolutely no question, for example, that there was a very close connection between the great droughts of 1,000 years ago and climatic events in the Pacific, La Nina and El Nino. And some remarkable research on a teeny Pacific atoll, hundreds of miles from anywhere southwest of Hawaii, has revealed old coral, which shows that 1,000 years ago, there was a prolonged period of La Nina-like dry, cool conditions over much of the eastern Pacific at the time when the medieval warm was flourishing in Europe. And this, of course, brings drought. And if we get a prolonged La Nina-like condition now, as it seems quite possible we will, there will be long droughts. On the other hand, if you have major El Niños, in the West we get 100-year rains. They do in the Andes, too. But other parts of the world, like northeast Brazil, the Sahel, south of the Sahara, and so on, receive, or West Africa, East Africa, receive major, major droughts in lieu. So there are pluses and minuses to both of them. And a major El Nino, like that of 1998, can really, truly have devastating effects on large areas of the world. So we live at the mercy of this seesaw.
Mm. Yeah. We have an email, Pete from La Crosse. Could you comment on how climate change might have led to the collapse of the Easter Island population, a population that was clearly already pushing the limits of what their land could support?
Oh, somebody's been reading Jared Diamond. It's funny, I got asked this question in a radio program yesterday. Easter Island is a very unique situation. It's very isolated. It is a place which became massively deforested. And as Jared Diamond pointed out, this may have been due to human activity. In fact, I believe a recent piece of research has suggested that apart from humans, that the importation of rats may have had a major effect on the forest deforestation of the island.
Ugh.
But the effects generally of deforestation and so on in Easter Island probably were not so much climatic as they were humanly caused, either by the import of rats or by simply felling of trees.
Huh. Fritz is next from Fish Creek. Hi, Fritz.
Hi.
Good morning.
I was out in Arizona and saw some of the ruins out there, and totally interesting. But a previous caller had talked about, you know, growing grains in the Midwest. Well, our lake level, even with the phenomenal amount of precipitation we had over the winter, hasn't come up any. It's near record low on Lake Michigan. So I don't know. I see climate change happening. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Thank you, Fritz.
I think the point about that is a perfectly valid point that Fritz has made, but there were two things. One is weather, which is what we get, and our memories of weather tend to be, oh, it's been a record year for rain or a record year for cold or whatever. But if you look at climate, which is the longer-term thing, there were these constant cycles. As I said earlier, during the medieval warm, there were periods when there was more rainfall, there were periods when there was less, there were periods when there was moderate rainfall and warmer temperatures. So really, it's very difficult to generalize. Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the Great Lakes, really, so I can't give you a considered judgment. But a lot of this, again, you may get heavy rainfall, and the effects may take a couple of years to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Fritz, so much for your call. We have time for a couple more phone calls before we have to say goodbye to this hour. The number is 800-486-8655. 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Jim from Oshkosh, hi.
Good morning, thank you.
there are only two sources of heat for our planet that I can figure out. One is external from the sun, and the second one is internal from the molten core, which comes to the surface in the form of volcanoes and earthquakes and things like that. My question is, I hear nobody or very few people talking about the solar radiation and the measurement of that. When I went to college and graduated right around the late 60s, early 70s, they were thinking we were going to go into a very cooling period, maybe even a mini ice age, because the lessening of the solar radiation. Back in 1988, as concerning volcanoes, we had a major volcanic eruption in Mount Pinatubo in Indonesia that dramatically changed our weather here in the Midwest, made it much cooler and longer spring, or later spring as such. And last year, as I've been watching, there's been at least probably 10 or 12 volcanoes throughout the globe that have been going off at various times and putting lots of gases, greenhouse gases, others into the atmosphere, not counting how many earthquakes and volcanoes have gone off under the ocean that we don't know about that can affect these La Niñas and La Niños. So my question is, who is doing any studies on the solar radiation and or the effect of volcanoes and so forth from the internal going off? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
There is a huge body of information on the effects of volcanoes on climate. There's the famous year without a summer of 1816, I think, or 1817, which really devastated crops in Europe. It was a volcano in Southeast Asia, Mount Tambora, that blew up. And that was the famous year in which the poet Shelley's wife told stories because of the bad weather, which turned into the story of Frankenstein, which is a rather lovely one. But there is a great deal of study, particularly of Icelandic and Asian volcanoes, which is showing that they tend to have very dramatic short-term effects on the climate. Solar radiation is an interesting subject. I don't know much about it, but I do know that during the 17th century, there was a period of subdued solar radiation and sunspot activity called the Maunder Minimum, which contributed to the cold then. And I think the wave of, and someone may correct me, of work on solar radiation in the 80s was connected to a temporary reduction of solar sunspot activity, but this may have resumed, and I simply don't know much about it. But it is an important factor, and there are people working on it.
What do you think we should be doing right now, Brian, to make things better?
I think one of the things we need to do is education. I think in the schools we don't spend enough time talking about climate, talking about the future, talking about living with things like drought and rising sea levels and warming. Because there are two issues. One is, how do we stop global warming? And the other one is far more important, which is, oddly enough, often neglected, which is, how do we live with it? And I think an awful lot of this is changing social attitudes. For example, I talked somewhat lightheartedly about golf the other day. I mean, we've got to start thinking about living responsibly with the water we have, not just a group of experts, but everybody.
Right.
And changing people's social attitudes, particularly in an era when we live from one political poll to the next, one election to the next, is going to be very hard, because this is an issue not necessarily of us, but for our great-grandchildren.
Right. And you don't hear too many people talking about changing golf, Brian. I'm afraid it's a discussion that's just not happening.
I know, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because if somebody develops a method of playing golf in the deserts, which does not involve large quantities of water, they're going to become very rich, I suspect.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. And what about you? As you've traveled the world and studied all of this, are there things that have made you change your life?
Yes, a lot of things. One is the one I gave you. The other one was walking in that herd of elephants in Africa. That was a very formative experience. Another one was crossing the Atlantic in a sailboat and 1,000 miles from anywhere, finding garbage in the water. And lots of little things like that. And these change your life because you see it at first hand. I've been terribly lucky. I've had a lot of extraordinary experiences. But nearly all of them, one way, have touched me on the other. And the other one is, the most striking to me is how unconscious we are of the level of what most people in humanity live, whether they live in cities or towns. Our awareness of poverty, for example, is very low.
Right. Thank you, Brian, so much for being with us. Always a delight to talk to you. We learned so much. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Brian Fagan, his book is The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It is his account of shifting climatic conditions and the consequences from about 800 to 1300, which is often referred to as the medieval warm period. Widespread drought, catastrophic rainfall, toppled dynasties, ruined civilizations, but also at a time for Europe when there was more planting and people were building cathedrals like Chartres. It's a great read, and he's a great guest, isn't he? Emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Born in England, did field work in Africa, and has written about forensic archaeology, early man, and many other topics. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. For all of your calls, we thank you, everybody, as well. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11, talking about interesting topics. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.